once again with Chris Deasy, who is, as I've established before, the world's premier cinema goer. And he's just returned very recently from a trip to the Sundance Film Festival, Chris. How was that? Let's just start off with talking about that very briefly.
No, it was amazing because I watch films, as you say, all the time. So, I mean, going to the cinema is a labour of love. But to go to a film festival where there are films showing that you know may never see the light of day again, and actually going to press screenings where a lot of the people were involved in the distribution of films, and so they were there really to see whether they wanted to buy the films, and people actually would then like be leaving after half an hour or an hour, which I thought was quite sort of disrespectful, but I guess they're thinking, yeah, no, not for me, so I'm going to leave. Or maybe they're leaving early in order to try and get that deal before someone else does the same. So I saw lots of films, very character-driven, very much in the sort of Robert Redford style, And I just sort of saw these really overwhelming films from various cultures and various continents, and watching it with an audience who were really engaging with it and actually, you know, laughing along, crying along, clapping, maybe a bit of walking out as well. But yeah, and a beautiful place because Utah is very snowy. It was minus 15 at one point. To leave a cinema, and all wonderfully air-conditioned and appropriately sort of, you know, they know how to deal with snow, let's put it that way, over in Utah, where they get lots of it. But yeah, and what a wonderful backdrop for a film festival. So yeah, and so I was getting up in the morning and watching films at like 9 o'clock. And normally I watch films of an evening, and that's like my treat after being at work all day. So here my job was to watch the film. So I was thinking, yeah, I could do this again.
Well, I'm glad you had a fantastic time. So that was a brand new film. This film we're going to talk about is Tarantino's Jackie Brown. Now, this film came out, the tenuous reason for doing this podcast is that it's 25 years since the UK release of Jackie Brown. Now, I think we both agree, we've both had this argument before, that this is probably our favourite Tarantino film.
Oh, big time.
And I think when I did my Best Film of the 90s podcast, I robbed you of making this your number one, because I wanted to talk about this film. So I was a bit cruel to you there. But now I'm returning the favour by allowing you to talk about your interest in Jackie Brown now. So I like Reservoir Dogs. I like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Those two films and Jackie Brown always circulate in my top three. But Jackie Brown's a really special film. I think we can both agree on that. Do you have any specific memories of going to see the film in 1998 at the cinema, presumably?
Yeah, no, I saw it at the UCI in Tamworth. I was visiting a friend, and it was Good Friday. So actually, there was one bit in the film where it says 3 days later, and I was like, oh, this, you know, this is Tarantino's, you know, sort of the closest he's ever going to get to a biblical epic, although that's another discussion about how actually he'd make a brilliant biblical epic. I just think it would be one that a lot of churches would be boycotting.
It's a real shame if he does do his 10 films and out, and he doesn't do a biblical epic as part of those 10 movies, wouldn't it?
Yeah, no, I think he'd be up for it. I think he would have to do it on his own terms, but it would certainly be a big sort of conversation starter and ender. But no, I saw it at the UCI Tamworth, and also it was the day of the Good Friday peace agreement, which is very much back in the news at the moment, because obviously we're talking now in 2023, so 25 years on, and that was an interesting backdrop, because it was a time when suddenly Northern Ireland looked like it might be going in a direction of peace, which broadly has been the case. But the film also, I think, wrong-footed a lot of people, because they were expecting another more gratuitously violent Pulp Fiction-type film. Violence is integral to the film, but also, a bit like Clint Eastwood's Unforgiven, it kind of also deconstructs the violence at the same time, and it offers other scenarios, including negotiation, and the very clever, almost like political strategies that Pam Grier's character and Robert Forster's character do at the end in order to try and outmaneuver Samuel L. Jackson. And so the film seemed to sort of fit with a particular zeitgeist, really, at that period. Obviously, coincidentally, because when that film was made and it was released in America, Christmas in 97, so 3 months later it came out here in, I think it was beginning of April, wasn't it? So very beginning of April 1998. And I actually saw it twice at the cinema. I saw it at UCI Tamworth when I was visiting a friend. And then I saw it, funny enough, 3 days later at the UCI in Swansea when I was on my way back to where I was living at the time in West Wales. So that film I've seen four times in total, twice at the cinema when it came out in 98, and then in 2019 in Ashford at the Picture House, and then for the 25th anniversary, although really it was 24 and a half years, in September September 2022 at the Cineworld in Ashford.
Yeah, I think I saw it. And my memory might be hazy to the point of being a useless memory. But I think I saw that on a preview that it was like the Saturday night before it was released on the following Friday. And I don't know why I've got that memory. And because I remember really wanting to go and watch it again almost immediately and not being able to, because it was one of those back in those days, I used to go to the cinema quite a lot. And I remember thinking, you know, this, I really want to dig into this film again, and having to wait maybe another week felt like a real imposition at the time, and not being able to go. But I think I saw it on a preview. I think it was set, yes, for some reason, it was the Saturday night prior to it being released on the following Friday. And I've got no idea why that happened, but that seems like a really strong memory to me.
And that's interesting you say that, because I remember watching Heat, so around the same time, well, 96, and I saw it on a Saturday night the week before it was released. So, and that was also in Tamworth at the UCI. So maybe some of the big releases at that time were given a kind of like... Because you get it now with unlimited screenings with Cineworld.
Con Air as well was another film around the same time where a similar thing happened, where I saw that on a preview before the film was released. And I remember with Con Air, they showed the trailer to Con Air before Con Air came on, because they were still showing the regular trailers to the films that were upcoming. So I had to close my eyes for that bit, so I didn't see what was about to happen. But yeah, so that's my memory of it. I remember really liking it. I remember people going to see it quite a lot, because people were hyped up after Pulp Fiction. But I don't remember it being felt of as being particularly warmly received. A couple of my friends really, really liked it. But generally, I thought from what I recall, it was 3 stars in Empire and things like that, rather than, you know, 4 stars, 5 stars. It was generally seen as a drop off from Pulp Fiction, and certainly not as, it's a film that's not as hyper as that film and Reservoir Dogs. I wonder to what degree then, because one of the interesting things about the film, which you could argue is the case of all Tarantino films, is the references that he places into other movies, right, and the way that he places his film into kind of pop culture. And that's clear in Pulp Fiction, when and particularly in Kill Bill, when the film is designed as almost a parody, a pastiche of various other genres and areas of cinema, grindhouse and exploitation-style cinemas. In the case of something like Grindhouse, the title of the movie is referencing a particular area of cinema. In this film, he does it in more subtle ways. So there's a scene where... Pam Grier, she's having her hearing about whether she's going to be given bail, the bail hearing, and then she's put back. And just before that, it's preceded by the song Long Time Woman on the soundtrack, which Pam Grier herself sings. And that's the song from the film The Big Dollhouse, which Pam Grier stars in, right? So that's a reference to that. And then the judge who's presiding over the bail hearing is played by an actor called Sid Haig, who is in The Big Dollhouse as well, right? And so, but you're not to know this unless you dig into it. You've seen The Big Dollhouse, you know who Sid Haig is. If you know who Sid Haig is, you know that he's in several films with Pam Grier, often where they play lovers, sometimes where they play people who are at odds with each other. So having those kind of intertextual references, but he does it in a far more subtle way in this film than he does in some of his other films. And I think the other thing that crops up, which isn't necessarily what Tarantino imagined would happen, is that Michael Keaton plays Ray Nicolette in the Steven Soderbergh film
Out of Sight.
Out of Sight, yeah, which was, I think, the year after. You know best.
Or is it
the same year?
No, I saw that, because it may have been released differently in America. I saw that in the autumn of 98, so it would have been after Jackie Brown.
Right, so after Jackie Brown...
So I saw Out of Sight. Out of Sight for me was nothing like as audacious
a film. Also based on an Elmore Leonard book.
Yeah,
that's why
but the same characters appearing. Yeah. And that was so... And at the time, I suppose you had all those sort of... This was the era of all those Scream films and the sort of intertextual sort of things. But to have a characters wandering from one movie to another and playing the same kind of role, that felt really odd, you know, at the time. It was very sort of meta, very sort of postmodern.
Yeah, so what about the plot, right, and the general mood of the film? Did it remind you at the time of anything you'd seen before, or did it feel really fresh?
Well, it was obviously paying homage to all of those 70s blaxploitation films, which I hadn't seen. And so I was, and of course I'd done a lot of reading, I probably read it, Empire magazine and others, so I was aware that there was a lot of prehistory, because that's what Tarantino did so well, of taking, he did it with John Travolta as well, characters who'd perhaps also actors or actresses who'd kind of fallen out of the limelight a little bit, or their glory day was behind them, and he resurrected their careers. So I was kind of aware of the backstory to the film. And it felt kind of like a Tarantino film, but with a lot more backstory and a lot more edge, a lot more subtlety and complexity and character development than I was used to in the other films. Because we were aware that, you know, Reservoir Dogs is good in sort of very much in the moment, and you learn about the characters through their dialogue. But here with Jackie Brown, you've got a sense in which the characters, and it's sort of almost like both advancing the plot, but also meandering away from the plot at the same time, that you feel you're getting to know these characters. They're having normal conversation, and it's not doing it for show, because you've got all those references to, is it McDonald's and drinking, you know, in the Netherlands or in Holland, whatever it is, that you can drink beer or whatever it is in Pulp Fiction. And that's all very funny, but it's kind of done in a way that's meant to be very sort of hip, and it's sort of like, you know, these are hitmen having their conversation, but they're sort of talking about fast food and so on. But it kind of feels very hyper, very stylized, very funny. But with this film, Pulp Fiction, sort of with Jackie Brown, you really feel that those characters, they're kind of a bit older. I suppose, actually, thinking about it, probably younger than I am now in the case of Pam Grier's character. But they're kind of reflecting on an age where, you know, almost like reminiscing about the role that analog used to play in their lives and the crackle on the record. And I could utterly relate to that, growing up in the 80s, buying 7-inch singles and so on. So there was something about what she was saying that completely resonated. And this was in, you know, the late 90s, before we went completely digital, before we had Spotify and so on. So the film really resonated in that sort of way. And what was interesting is that even when I saw the film at the cinema for the fourth time just a few months ago, there were still bits of the plot that I hadn't completely processed. I think I actually wanted to read the screenplay as soon as I'd seen the film, because there were bits I didn't get. And actually the way in which Pam Grier manages to outsmart all of them at the end, and even we're not quite sure whether she's also been playing Robert Forster's Max Cherry as well, you know, who's taking whom for a ride. But it almost didn't matter, because it was so character-driven, it was so strong in trying to bring this world to light, that I kind of knew that I would be returning to that movie again and again, and there would always be new avenues to explore. I mean, did you actually get to see it upon its release as well as on that Saturday night?
Yes, I think I went to see it another couple of times. Yeah. I was at university at the time, so I didn't have as much time as I had before that, when I saw Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction a number of times. I was always disappointed with Pulp Fiction, because I was a big fan of Reservoir Dogs. Now, Reservoir Dogs, because that wasn't released on video, home video in this country, it kept coming back to local cinemas. So I actually saw that in the cinema in double figures. At least 10 times I saw Reservoir Dogs over a number of years between its release and when it was brought out on home video. And every time it would be brought back onto the local cinemas, it would always have a big audience and people who'd heard about it and word of mouth. And me and some friends were really big fans of Reservoir Dogs. When Pulp Fiction came out, it didn't feel as fresh. And I think a lot of people who hadn't seen Reservoir Dogs were maybe blown away by Pulp Fiction. But if you knew Reservoir Dogs and something like True Romance as well, which I was a big fan of, which Tarantino wrote but he didn't direct, Pulp Fiction was a bit of a letdown. And I still think it is a bit of a letdown, and I would put it right at the bottom of my rankings of Tarantino films, if I had to rank them, just above something like Death Proof, really. Mm. Whereas Jackie Brown was the complete reversal of that. I mean, it's up there in my, if it's not my favourite, it's very, very close to being my favourite Tarantino film.
And was it at the beginning as well? So when, was that also your first impression on the day that you saw it?
I would say not on the day that I saw it, but within the second or third time I'd seen it. Certainly by the time I had it on video, then it was my favourite. And whether it provides the same rush that Reservoir Dogs provided, no, it doesn't. But it's kind of it's joy. The joys of Jackie Brown are somehow deeper and more satisfying than Reservoir Dogs somehow.
I mean, it's the pacing that works. And maybe that is the answer to your question as well, because it feels that whereas with Pulp Fiction, that there's all, you know, the timeline is all sort of messed up. I mean, Tarantino does a similar thing in Jackie Brown in the scene that I'm sure we'll come to about the set in the department store when you see it through the three times over. But the pacing is so slow, almost languid, that what it does, it means that the characters are just washing over you. Now, it takes real skill to accomplish that, because it could otherwise be seen as something that's very sort of dragged out. Pulp Fiction is very bitey, and it's very lots of different characters, and they're there, then the next vignette. And it kind of feels that it has, it's a very punchy kind of film. Ironic that Rum Punch is the source, the Elmore Leonard source for this film. But how interesting that it has scope to breathe. And some of the scenes that I most remember are just of the characters talking to one another, getting to know each other better. And it's a chance to savour. And it's like catching up with old friends again. They remain the same age, but I'm now older than they were. Maybe not Robert Forster's character, but certainly Pam Grier's character, than when I first saw it. So it feels almost as like catching up with relatives and friends.
You don't often get chit-chatty dialogue in movies. It's very often about advancing plot or character. And I think this film, every line is advancing plot or character, but it doesn't give you the impression it's advancing plot or character. And I think I've said before, but I like it fits very much into that 90s slacker ethos. And films like Slacker by Richard Linklater and Dazed and Confused are kind of in the same wavelength. I think I've heard the expression related to Jackie Brown that it's a hangout movie. It's a thriller. It's a crime thriller, but it's also about characters just hanging out and watching television. And drinking in bars and in coffee shops and going to the mall. There's quite unusual in that there's a couple of scenes in this film where people aren't arguing. They're not talking about the plot, and they're just enjoying each other's company. There's two concurrent scenes. There's one where Odell comes back with Lewis, and he comes back to his house, and he's taken Lewis shopping, and they've brought him some new clothes because obviously he's just got out of prison. And the three of them are just chatting about getting high with Melanie, and they're just joking with each other. And that's followed immediately by a scene with the cop Dargus and Michael Keaton as Ray Nicolette, the ATF man. And they're in a room with Jackie, an interview room with Jackie Brown, and she says, "Can I smoke?" He says, "Yeah, sure, Jackie." He's like, "Hey, Jackie, how are you doing?" And you don't often see these scenes where characters are just chatting and not arguing. It's usually written as one line and a snappy comeback, and another line and a snappy comeback, rather than these characters just basically just hanging out with each other, talking, chatting in this quite naturalistic way. So I don't think at the time I'd seen much like that before. And there's obviously elements of it, like the blaxploitation dialogue, the street language, you know, the use of the N-word, which is borrowed completely from that blaxploitation era, felt familiar. It also felt unfamiliar in just seeing a film of this pace, I think. It's what the French theorist Michael Sheen would say is verbocentric, right? It's a very verbocentric film. So if I had to, this is a really difficult question, probably the most difficult question you're going to get asked today, is all the performances in this film are fantastic, right? But if you had to pick one, right, it's a completely artificial question, right? I'm going to force you to pick one performance that you like the most in terms of the character and the actor behind it. What would you say out of Jackie Brown is your favourite?
Okay, well, I'm going to give you a different answer to what I would have given you when I saw it.
Okay.
Because when I saw it, I was still am, but a big Robert De Niro fan. I did a lot of, I studied Taxi Driver and Cape Fear. They were sort of very much at the heart of the PhD I was doing at the time. Now, I think after the late 90s, so really after one or two films after this one, I kind of felt that he'd sort of lost his way a bit, and he was doing lots of cameos in other films. He wasn't doing the effort, he was this big method actor. He was brilliant in a way in Jackie Brown, because he plays somebody a bit, I suppose you could say it's a bit like his Jake LaMotta in Raging Bull, but he's very inarticulate, and of course everything about him, there's no sort of glamour to this. He's really, playing somebody very, very stupid in every way, and you sort of watching it and thinking, is he really acting? It's almost as though he's divested himself completely of it. It's just what you're just left with is this very sort of lumbering gangster who's very lazy and doesn't really seem to have much of a clue, and is just, he's obviously smoking a lot of stuff and isn't with it at all, and it was very funny to watch at the time. I remember thinking, oh, would he get an Oscar nomination for this? But Robert Forster got the Oscar nomination, and I'd never seen Robert Forster before. And I thought that what really worked about his character was just that he sort of, completely summed up the pace that Tarantino was going for in this. Because he was somebody who just seemed to be very sort of streetwise, but also kind of, rather than doing what the Jules and Verne do in Pulp Fiction, was it? Jules and Vince do in Pulp Fiction, where they are, you know, trying to be very, very clever. Here, he's almost like, I'm beyond all of that. You know that he sees retirement in view, but also is aware that he works with people who are kind of going to potentially stop him from ever reaching retirement because he's dealing with criminals and he's bailing them out. So you kind of know that he's somebody who's aware that he might not live forever. So he has to have his wits about him. But he's very sort of philosophical about it. And he's not really so much cynical as just somebody who you kind of feel is looking for another outlook. It's a bit like Carlito's Way, perhaps, in that sense. The sort of the criminal, although, you know, in that he's not a criminal, but he's dealing with criminals, but who sees paradise, who sees another life, sees an end, but may or may not get there. But you see in this, through his relationship with Jackie Brown, he's intrigued by her. She's not quite like anybody else he's ever worked with. And she's kind of playing him. But you kind of feel that he wants to be played as well. He's enamoured in her, and he sees a lot of authenticity in her. And he can't blame her. At the end of the day, she's going to be out of a job. And so, yeah, so she's taking his gun. She's compromising him. But he's like, I can't blame you. He sees a kindred spirit in her. And that, I thought, worked really well. It really connected. And it must have taken a lot of skill for Tarantino to really delineate those and get them to play off each other.
Yeah, it is a remarkable performance, and he was known really for exploitation films and for playing bad guys. He's in the film The Delta Force, where he's kind of how would you describe it? He's made to look more Middle Eastern than he actually is. Yeah. So playing some kind of Middle Eastern terrorist taking over a plane. It's that type of roles that he was known for. I don't think anyone would have ever expected him to be able to play something with such kind of subtlety and nuance as he does in Jackie Brown. But also that hints, doesn't it, to the tremendous professionalism of actors, is that they're all capable, or many of them are capable of doing lots of different things. But once you get typecast in a particular role in a particular thing and you get offered particular work, it's very difficult to get off that treadmill. And what I liked about Tarantino, particularly in those days, was his ability to take those people who'd been forgotten and discarded and to make them basically deliver career best performances. I mean, Pam Grier in this is obviously, it's what she's known for more than anything else now. And definitely Robert Forster. I like, I like the Louis Scarra character. I think what Tarantino said, that Louis is almost, he's out of step. Yeah. Like he takes, when somebody asks him a question, he takes an extra beat before answering the question. Or, you know, he's kind of like slightly, you know, play it off rhythm. Yeah. Right, there's something really interesting about the way he plays it off rhythm. There's the rhythm of the movie, and De Niro's character Gara has to be off that rhythm, which is really, really funny.
It's like, I remember a music teacher at school who said about Les Dawson, who was famous for, who could like play the piano really badly, but he said you have to play the piano really well in order to play it that badly. So rather, you know, it's like can he play? That's the whole performance. Same with Robert De Niro. You have to be a really, really good actor to act in a way that makes you look as though it's like, has he forgotten his lines? Why are all these pauses? You know, it's almost as though, as you say, rather than trying to do this really showcase barnstorming performance, he's going the opposite. He's becoming very introverted, and it's very comical to watch. But if you'd never seen Robert De Niro before, you might be thinking, you know, who is this guy? Is he, you know, what sort of training has he had? He just sort of seems to be completely like, his character's completely spaced out, or is it the actor that's spaced out? But you just know that this is De Niro, who's kind of, you know, going the opposite way, as are so many of the other characters in this film, to what you might expect. Robert Forster, I think, is just a case in point. That for him, you know, actually that bit when he goes to the movies and he says to his work associate, I'm gonna take the afternoon off, I'm gonna go and watch a film that sort of starts early and looks good kind of thing. And that almost is part of his character. So that sort of incidental thing, because you know that he's doing that because he also wants to catch a glimpse of Pam Grier's Jackie Brown, and he kind of does. So he's doing like the most mundane thing that we all do, but he's also kind of getting a kick out of this. He's kind of doing his own sort of detective work, and he finds and he able through piecing all the different, you know, for just being main streetwise, he kind of works out exactly what the game is, and he's able to piece it all together and kind of outmaneuver the master, you know, the Samuel Jackson character at the end of this. It's a very accomplished film, but it uses the most prosaic and everyday of events in order to create this almost like detective story template.
So regarding the music then, did you have any sense of these songs and these tracks before the film? And because now whenever I hear these songs and these tracks, I mean, it just reminds you of Jackie Brown. You can't, you've all the associations come from the movie. But I don't recall knowing many of these songs prior to the film. I mean, I was maybe a bit too young to know these, yeah. And they were kind of out-of-date artists at the time. So how about yourself?
Well, OK, that's really interesting, because the Delphonics, I know, is completely indissolubly linked to that film. Didn't I blow your mind this time? The Across 110th Street, that's Bobby Womack, isn't it?
Yeah.
Again, I don't know if I knew it before, but now it's just completely, you know, it's associated with that film. But the film, the song that I absolutely did know before and loved before I saw the film was Street Life. Now, that's always been a favourite, and suddenly I wasn't expecting it to appear in the film, and when it did, it just felt so much of its the groove, because it's obviously got a huge 70s groove, and that song with the Crusaders, Randy Crawford, I think was first released in possibly around sort of 77-ish. So this film used it, and it just felt completely appropriate. But there's that, and it has a very sort of audacious start. It sort of builds a da, 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 and then it sort of, you know, finds its way. And they're in the car, they're going to the department store. And it's suddenly like, where is this going? And I think I literally just jumped up in my seat and thought, what a brilliant, spectacular track to use. But now, of course, even though I knew that song very well before, I cannot dissociate it from Jackie Brown. So it's almost like the film really colonised that, and it took a piece of music that I already knew, but completely reframed it, almost like reinvented it, transformed it. And so now whenever I hear it, and I hear it a lot, I think immediately that fantastic scene in Jackie Brown. So the way that he uses the music in that, I think, is completely, you know, is second to none.
Yeah, and there's the Across 110th Street Bobby Womack song, that first appeared, although not that recording, in a film called Across 110th Street. There's a sort of blaxploitation from about 1973, I think it is, got Anthony Quinn and Yaphet Kotto in that film. Pretty good film. And I'm certain I'd seen that film prior to Jackie Brown, because I used to have it taped on VHS. That I'd done a tape. Somebody lent me a copy of it, and I'd copied it. But I didn't recognise the music, because it's such a different version of that tune. So it's a different recording of that song. So I didn't recognise it. But you've got also a link then. He's clearly with this. I mean, the film's set in the 1990s, but all the music's from the 70s, right? Yeah. So it's linking us. So the film's set in a particular time, but it's linking us culturally through the music to a completely different decade. Quite a clever thing to do there. In some respects, the Pulp Fiction soundtrack, they've got that kind of surf music predominates on the soundtrack there, which locates it at the kind of early 60s. And this film very much, I would imagine nearly all the songs on the soundtrack are 70s. There might be one or two that aren't. He often has one or two which are modern. Let me have a look at the soundtrack, see if there is any. Oh, that's it. There's the Foxy Brown rap song on the soundtrack, which I can't picture exactly where that comes in the movie. But there is a Foxy Brown song on the soundtrack. Foxy Brown was a hip-hop artist in the 90s, and also named after the film Foxy Brown, which stars Jackie Brown, that stars Pam Grier from the 1970s, the Jack Hill movie. It's easy to get yourself tied up in knots with this stuff, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, and almost deliberately so, because, as you say, that they're not playing standalone characters. There's an entire movie culture sort of backstory to all of this. But the use of sound in this film, I mean, I bought the soundtrack immediately, because in those days you'd have to wait like a year before you could buy your own VHS copy of the film. So I bought the soundtrack, I may even have bought the screenplay actually, straight afterwards. And I was just blown away by the way that he did the whole, in particular, the scene in the mall that you see three times over. Now, you could say, oh, that could drag. I know somebody at the time was saying to me, oh, you just see the same thing over and over and it's sort of a waste of 20 minutes. I mean, the opposite, because you're seeing it from one almost inane and mundane event of going into a shopping mall and taking a bag into the room, you know, to the dressing room. But what goes on within that from three perspectives, and you see the way that the story unfolds, and then you realise that this is all being done in order to try and, you know, play off characters against each other and to and a bit of a bribe going on in there and so on. But actually, it was just so cleverly done. And it was using the prosaic, using the everyday, using the mundane as a way in to try and work out how somebody can actually go up against, effectively, a crime lord, a gangster, and to actually win her life back. And then she does that by playing off the cops, the bondsman, and the gangster. And she walks away at the end. And she leaves a certain, you know, and what she leaves in her trail to that sound of the, you know, the across 110th Street is phenomenal. So it's actually the soundtrack there made the film. The soundtrack was a character in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I was reading that Tarantino, he conceived of these particular songs as he's writing the script, right? Yeah. So it's very much not an afterthought. Mm-hmm. It's almost built into what he would say, the rhythm of the writing, yeah. the rhythm of the dialogue, and the rhythm of the cutting as well, and the editing yeah. and things like that. So that's really interesting. So you bring back to this idea of the disappointment. Did you watch this film with anybody at the time?
Yeah, somebody I was going out with at the time, and she really liked it. She was maybe a bit sceptical. I think we'd seen Pulp Fiction together, so she was completely okay with the whole sort of Tarantino worldview. I think I'd also seen, maybe on my own, From Dusk Till Dawn, which obviously was starred rather than was directed by Tarantino. And I really liked that one. Mm-hmm. And I thought that that was sort of a film of having sort of a hybrid of two different genres. But what was so clever is that I just sort of sat there. And there are the scenes when the characters are talking about the music, particularly Max and the Pam Grier character. And they're talking about the Delphonics. And it's like in an age when we were starting to go digital, you know, this was an age when certainly CDs were, you know, but they were making a case for records, and that's the only way to listen. And that's the way I grew up, you know, sort of listening to the crackle on the vinyl. So, and they were almost being nostalgic in the 90s. I mean, we might be nostalgic now 25 years on after that film, but there was a sense in which they were, and of course Pam Grier was very much a 70s icon. So there was something in that film that encapsulated, you know, people in their middle age, people in their late 40s or whatever age they are, and reflecting on their lives and the way that music plays a part in that. And just the pace, which was, I thought, so clever in the way that it was just executed, that there are scenes of characters just talking about the music. And I was just washed over me. And I was just transfixed and intoxicated by that film from start to finish. I never quite knew how it was going to play out. I never knew the direction of travel. And lots of those music, the Randy Crawford one in particular, which has always been a favourite, was just used at the perfect moment. And you almost see the character suddenly change gear. That scene, they're going into the mall, isn't it? And they're playing Street Life by the Crusaders. And suddenly you kind of know that it's moving into another kind of gear.
In terms of that then, what's your feeling on the idea of the soundtrack as a nostalgia piece yeah. for you? So the because what you've got, we've got two stages of nostalgia happening here, and you're an expert on nostalgia. We've got our nostalgia here. The soundtrack reminds us of Jackie Brown, but in the film, the songs remind the characters of their childhood or their growing up or their lives. And I think there's that two-step process, yeah. I think, is quite interesting what's happening.
And how ironic that, indeed, we're celebrating the 25th anniversary. But so I was probably only about 25 when I saw it. In fact, I probably was only 24 going on 25. So this has been with me for half my life. But people like Pam Grier, who I didn't quite grow up with because I was too young, this was kind of 25 years, almost exactly 25 years before Jackie Brown was made. So they're nostalgic in the late 90s for a very 70s groove. And now here we are 25 years later, when vinyl itself has very much sort of come back. So it was almost as if the things they were reflecting over feel timeless.
I think that moment where she turns the tables on Ordell, when Ordell goes to her apartment to yeah. kill her, is probably my favourite yeah. scene in the film. I'll ask you what your favourite scene was in a moment. Hope it's not the same scene. Yeah. But the bit where she and Ordell keeps turning the lights down, yeah. and as she goes yeah. back, she'll turn the lights back yeah. up. And of course, she knows at that point that she's got the gun, and it's revealed that she's got the gun in that split screen moment where we cut back to Max Cherry, and he realizes that she's taken his gun from his glove box. That scene's such a fantastic scene in the way that the actors play it, and just the reversal of when she turns the tables on Ordell there is very funny. And you see a real different side of her. And you see a different side of her is when she uses the word that Ordell had been using a lot up until that point, which is the N-word, right? She uses the N-word on him at that point. And that, I think, the film's not a terribly violent film. There's violence in it, but it's not a terribly yeah. violent film. So I think this country, it was only a 15 certificate. Yeah. Yeah. But he did get a little bit of criticism for using the N-word. And watching it again the other night, you think that's really, really, really prominent. And he was really bringing that kind of blaxploitation kind of vernacular to 90s cinema in a way that I don't think had really been heard before. And I wonder whether that makes it contemporary or whether that dates it or what the impact of that was. Did you get a sense of that watching the film in the 25th anniversary screen?
I did. And I think even at the time it felt odd to have it was a black character using that N-word. But I remember that maybe it was an Empire magazine and they said at the time that maybe that there were more uses of either the F-word or maybe that word than... I think up to that point, Goodfellas and Scarface were sort of the films that had the most use of certain words. And I'm pretty sure that Jackie Brown was sort of up there in that sort of, you know, list of, you know, the use of the choice use of language. Yeah, how interesting, isn't it, that film, it feels now, you know, particularly written by a white man, you know, it you probably wouldn't get away with it now, actually, in the same way. I remember being aware of it at the time, but I think, you know, it did feel as I was watching it, ouch, you know, a few times.
You watched it recently?
I did feel that, yeah. But it felt that this was something that was, it doesn't quite fit now, that, you know, he could get away with it at the time because he was doing something very bold. I think these days that would be challenged very much.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I can't comment on the disrespectful nature of it. I mean, I think his justification for it is that it comes from that world. Mm. It's from, and if you think of the kind of, you know, he uses kind of hip hop music on the soundtrack as well, and it comes from the kind of street language that the blaxploitation films emerge out of anyway. There's the book Pimp by Iceberg Slim, by a writer who used to be a pimp in Chicago in the 1940s, and he wrote he wrote a lot of hip hop artists, right? And he just writes the entire book in this kind of street language, and I think Tarantino is very much using the N-word in that context. But I absolutely take the point that if you were, it feels out of time, particularly to this cultural moment. Why do you think there's been this shift from Jackie Brown being thought of as maybe, it was this third directorial film, and it was probably thought of generally, I would think, as the weakest of the three at the time. Not that we agreed with that, but I think generally people thought that. Why do you think there's this been reappraisal over the last 25 years?
I think he's played the long game. I think that that film, though very much sort of in its, you know, very much set... maybe, you know, made in the 90s, but sort of imbibing the 70s. It has an inbuilt nostalgia to it. The characters are themselves reflecting. You mentioned the word wistful. They're reflecting on a different era. Something has changed. Now, that is timeless. That is priceless. Pulp Fiction, on the other hand, is very much of its day, you know, and almost sort of made in 94. And it was great at the time, and it was like the big thing that, you know, everybody had to see. It felt very cutting edge. It felt very clever. Very cool. But somehow, all these decades later, I don't think I've seen it, actually, in years. How come I've seen Jackie Brown several times, including at the cinema in recent years, but not Pulp Fiction? And it's interesting that Pulp Fiction worked at the moment. And it's that was such an interesting thing, because the year that Pulp Fiction came out, the other films up for Best Picture at the Oscars were all kind of real landmark pictures, because Forrest Gump won. That's kind of fallen from favour for all sorts of reasons, including the fact that it may not be entirely politically correct. Quiz Show, which I think was actually a very accomplished Robert Redford film. But there was also Four Weddings and the Funeral, which is iconic. You also had The Shawshank Redemption, which, of course, at the time, like, nobody had seen, and then now it's like, you know, one of the, ranked in many people's eyes as one of the greatest films ever. And of course you had Pulp Fiction. So it was one of those years when there seemed to be all these incredibly iconic films all sort of out at the same time. But I would say quite a few of those perhaps haven't lasted the course. Jackie Brown only got a very small number of Oscar nominations. The one that stands out, obviously, is Robert Forster, Best Supporting Actor. But how that film, which started as a very sort of low base, has kind of... almost as if there was a kind of the long view in place, that whether Tarantino intended that or not, it outlasted all the others, which burnt out far more quickly. And I think Jackie Brown, because of its reflexivity, anybody watching that now, anybody watching in 20 years' time, can get that. Whereas Pulp Fiction will just seem very dated. Unless you were there at the time, it kind of won't. I don't think it will work in quite the same way to other generations.
Chris, once again, thanks very much for your time. It's been a real pleasure talking to you about this, because I know we're big fans of this film, and I robbed you of being able to choose this as your favourite film.
We've made up for it. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Newton Talks will return.